5. To Brazil and back. Squeezed out. In the same years that Benny was in Kansas, life for Indonesians of Chinese descent like him got increasingly difficult back home. They had long suffered from intermittent explosions of racism, but as lines in the sand were drawn and redrawn under Sukarno's guided democracy, there seemed to be less and less space for them. The first major blow was a 1959 law passed just as Benny was heading to Kansas that took some economic rights away from foreign nationals. In practice, this included the country's large ethnic Chinese population. It was not Sukarno who pushed for this, it was the military, but he let the racist law, a deviation from Indonesia's foundational values, pass. The army also organized violent anti-Chinese riots for which it did not seek Sukarno's approval. The military used U.S. funds to plot these pogroms. The situation was terrifying. Many Indonesians of Chinese descent began to look for a way out. This included the Tan family, whom we met briefly in the introduction. Chiang Bing and Tui Nyo lived in Jakarta, not too far from Francisca's home. Chiang Bing, the father of the family, had come from a line of farmers but worked as an engineer in the largely Chinese section of North Jakarta, where life had become tense. Many in their community moved to China, but their family was looking for a different opportunity. Prospects for Canada or the U.S. were grim. They had heard, however, that some Chinese Indonesians had gone to Brazil, which offered good opportunities and relative freedom from discrimination. The trickle of immigration started in the early 1960s, and as a result, stories of Brazil made their way back to Jakarta and to the Tans. So the family decided to board the Chitjelenka, a big old Dutch hospital ship that had been used to carry prisoners of war during World War II, with their three children. Chiang Bing never actually got permission to leave his engineering job, his daughter Ingyok remembers. He just ran away. His exit papers might have even been faked. "We'll figure it all out after we get on the boat," he told the kids. It wasn't easy to keep three little girls healthy and happy as they inched their way around the globe. Ingyok kept throwing up, but 6 weeks later, they pulled into the port of Santos in the state of Sao Paulo. The China of the 1960s. Ingyok was only a little girl when she first saw Brazil, and it was a very different place from what she was used to. Perhaps for those reasons, the country's major characteristics jumped out at her more clearly than they would to North Americans or even to Brazilians. First, she realized very quickly that Brazil is a Western European settler colony with extreme inequality and a very obvious racial hierarchy. This all became apparent as her family moved into an apartment in Brooklyn, the Sao Paulo neighborhood named after the New York borough, and her parents got her into an upper-middle-class Catholic school. There, most of the kids were white, and it was clear that these white people ran the country. In the streets around her were people with dark or black skin, mostly descended from slaves, and still obviously treated like second-class citizens. She was part of a third group, a community of more recent immigrants that was classed somewhere between the white and black people, allowed to ascend to the middle class, but always treated with a healthy dose of ridicule. The kids called her Hapa. Sao Paulo has a large Japanese community, and she was often confused with Brazilians of Japanese descent who were higher on the racial ladder than the blacks. And she knew there was a fourth race somewhere far away, although she had little contact with them, Brazil's indigenous people, who were discussed as though they were barely human. Other things were new to her. Brazil had only one language, Portuguese, and it came from Europe, not from Brazil. White colonizers had brought it with them, and it had functionally annihilated all the local languages. This was very different from Indonesia, of course, which spoke to itself in a hurricane of intermixed indigenous languages that had essentially blown Dutch away before she was born. And there was just one religion, Christianity. The colonizers had brought it, and Brazil's local traditions were practiced only in the jungle far away, somewhere she knew she wasn't expected to go. It was all very different from Indonesia, which had five or six religions, depending on how you counted. It was pretty obvious what Ingyok was supposed to do. Study hard, move up toward the part of society occupied by the white people, and adopt their manner of doing things. She was a smart girl, and so she did well. The Tan family did not realize until they arrived in 1962 that Brazil was in political crisis. At least, it surely looked that way to the United States. by far the largest country in Latin America, and for a long time Washington's most important ally in the region, Brazil appeared to be wobbling away from the U.S. orbit. This didn't just trouble the North Americans, it troubled much of Brazil's elite too. Unlike in Indonesia, Washington's officials here did not have to adjust a vastly different local culture and then plant the seeds of an anti-communist movement. In Brazil, they were able to work easily with conservative political forces that had emerged from Brazil's own history. The Portuguese arrived in this part of South America around 1500, and like so many other places in the colonial world, it was named for one of its first raw material exports, Brazilwood, or Pau Brasil. This huge chunk of South America, twice the size of the European Union, technically ended up in Portuguese hands because of the 1494 Treaty of Tordesillas, or rather, when the Pope drew an arbitrary line down a very badly drawn map to split the New World between Spain and Portugal. The indigenous population who fell into the newly designated Portuguese territories lived differently from those who lived in modern-day Mexico or Peru. There was no large centrally governed empire like the Aztec or Inca, but smaller, more self-sufficient groups. In the very early years, Europeans made tentative alliances with these tribes, intermarrying and fighting and losing battles and forming new alliances and being captured only to escape and send largely true, if sensational, accounts of cannibalism back to Europe. The most famous European to relate this experience survived only by crying and begging for his life, leading the locals to believe he was too weak and pathetic to be worth eating. He became a best-selling author. By the time the Europeans had subdued the native population, they decided that indigenous Brazilians, who were dying from disease and brutal enslavement, did not provide enough free labor for the extraction of natural resources for export. So, Brazil imported almost 5 million human beings from Africa, far more than the United States did, and equal to almost half of all slaves brought to the Americas. Just as in the U.S., enslavement in Brazil was unimaginably cruel. In addition to the whip, stocks, and iron collars studded with spikes to prevent escape, slave owners affixed iron masks, which prevented the slaves from committing suicide by shoving earth into their own mouths. When it came to independence from Europe, most other countries and Latin America threw Spain out in violent revolutions in the early 19th century. But in Brazil, the Portuguese royal family fled Napoleon's invading forces and set up shop in Rio de Janeiro in 1807, bringing the capital of the empire to the colonies. Thousands of Europeans did their best to set up a royal court in Rio, and they established a local monarchy which ruled until 1889 and still has some unofficial influence today. Soon after the liberation of African descendant Brazilians in 1881, the largest country in South America promptly embarked upon a policy of explicit branqueamento, or whitening. The idea was to bring the white immigrants and to breed the African blood out of the population through miscegenation. Newly freed slaves were intentionally left languishing in poverty rather than paid to work in the new system. This approach was also what brought Ingyoc's Japanese classmates to Sao Paulo. Brazilians deemed the Japanese, which they categorized as the whites of Asia, the most desirable Asian immigrants. This racism remained public and paramount, with cultural organizations producing posters to show that a Japanese man and a Brazilian woman would produce white offspring. More conservative in outlook than its neighbors, Brazil looked more to Washington than to Spanish-speaking Latin America. From the fall of the monarchy to the middle of the 20th century, Brazil enjoyed a special relationship with Washington, which would often play the role of conciliator between the U.S. and Spanish-speaking Latin America. In 1940, Brazil became the first Latin American nation to sign a military staff agreement with U.S. military officials in Washington. The State Department saw Brazil as the key to South America because of its size and mineral wealth. In 1949, the Escola Superior de Guerra, ESG, was founded, modeled after the U.S. National War College, where some Brazilians had trained. Outside the military, this special relationship began to fall apart at the beginning of the Cold War. President Eurico Gaspar Dutra, in office 1946-51, did everything he could to join Washington's anti-Soviet campaign, including breaking off relationships with Moscow and banning the Brazilian Communist Party, PCB, the strongest communist party in Latin America. But President Dutra also believed that the United States was standing in the way of Brazil's economic development. The U.S., the only available source of capital for Brazil's huge public investment needs after World War II, refused to grant the loans Dutra's government requested, surprising Washington's wartime ally. The two countries also clashed over the cost of coffee, an extremely important Brazilian export. But the greatest source of friction between the two largest countries in the hemisphere was the question of U.S. corporate involvement in the oil sector. Brazilian lawmakers wanted to favor local petroleum companies, while Washington insisted U.S. firms be allowed to operate in the country. By 1949, Brazilians felt exasperated by apparent gringo indifference to Brazil's economic position, and in 1950, Dutra issued a public rebuke when he politely declined to assist the U.S. in Korea. When Getúlio Vargas, a longtime force in Brazilian politics, returned to the presidency in 1951, relations with the U.S. only worsened. He had been a dictator in the 1930s and 40s, but had reinvented himself as a democratically elected populist. Although Vargas had a history of fiercely repressing communism in his own country, when Getúlio Vargas, a longtime force in Brazilian politics, returned to the presidency in 1951, relations with the U.S. only worsened. He had been a dictator in the 1930s and 40s, but had reinvented himself as a democratically elected populist. Although Vargas had a history of fiercely repressing communism in his own country, and Brazil supported John Foster Dulles's cherished anti-communist declaration at the Caracas Conference just before the Guatemala coup, after another fight over aid, he too concluded the U.S. was opposed to Brazilian economic development and announced the country would support colonial freedom struggles at the UN. By this point in the Cold War, this was an obvious affront to Washington's policy. Vargas also proposed a tax on excess profits that would clearly affect foreign investors, and then oversaw the creation of Petrobras, a state-owned oil monopoly. The reaction in the United States to all of this was predictably hostile. The New York Times reported that the competent opinion was that Brazil could never raise the money required to extract its own petroleum, so that effectively, what the government did was to bury deep in the ground whatever oil reserves Brazil has. Not only for these reasons, the Escola Superior de Guerra began plotting to remove Vargas with U.S. support. But it never happened. Soon after a decree to double the minimum wage caused outrage among Brazil's elite, everything came crashing down on its own. Carlos Lacerda, the most prominent critic of President Vargas in Brazil, was attacked by gunmen while walking in Copacabana. He survived with a bullet wound to the foot, while a military officer accompanying him did not make it. It soon emerged that the attempted assassination may have been ordered by someone in the president's own bodyguard force. The military was definitely coming for Vargas now, and they were going to succeed. Rather than let that happen, Vargas wrote a final letter to the country, then shot himself in the chest on August 24, 1954, upturning politics forever from beyond the grave. The victor of the election that followed in 1955, Juscelino Kubitschek, was a pro-U.S. centrist and economic nationalist. Nonetheless, Washington viewed him with suspicion. During his campaign, the United States Information Service doubled its budget for programs to educate Brazilians on the dangers of communism and communist front organizations. U.S. officials also sought to expose ties between the banned PCB and the Soviet Union. The Communist Party endorsed Kubitschek, or JK for short. Almost all Brazilian presidents get nicknames, causing him even more problems, despite the fact that the small PCB was illegal and JK disavowed its support. As president, JK built things. He undertook an ambitious infrastructure program and built a new capital, Brasilia, from scratch in the middle of the country. Still, the Eisenhower administration refused to agree to an important long-term assistance program for Brazil, specifically because they didn't want to boost Kubitschek's popularity. But it was the ascendance of JK's vice president, a young, left-leaning Bohemian named João Goulart, often referred to simply by his childhood name, Django, that really concerned the North Americans. As the former labor minister for Vargas, Goulart had introduced the explosive bill to double the minimum wage in 1954. He was firmly a member of Brazil's elite political establishment, a millionaire landowner, and devout Catholic, but Goulart's proposed reforms set off alarm bells in Washington. This was not little Cuba, they reasoned. This was one of the world's biggest countries. If Django was not stopped, warned U.S. Ambassador Lincoln Gordon, Brazil could become the China of the 1960s. Gordon, a former professor at Harvard Business School, had worked on the Marshall Plan before absorbing modernization theory and helping design the Alliance for Progress. He was an old friend of Richard Bissell, the Frank Wisner CIA recruit who had designed the plans to assassinate Lumumba and take Cuba at the Bay of Pigs. When Gordon arrived in Brazil in 1962, he recognized quickly that hypermegalopolis Sao Paulo was a lot like his native New York, in that it had an elite class, the 400 families that dominated the city's social and economic life, but also had a large class of immigrant families, like his own, striving to realize the American dream. The democracy Brazil set up after World War II was very limited. Striking was illegal. Because of literacy requirements, a majority of the population, mostly black, very poor Brazilians, was barred from voting. Django and his supporters wanted to change this, just as a growing civil rights movement in the U.S. was putting pressure on Washington to repeal racist voting restrictions there. Goulart served as vice president under JK from 1955 to 1960. Then in 1960, he ran to serve as vice president again, this time under Jânio Quadros, a theatrical provisional politician backed by the right-leaning UDN party. Despite his conservative leanings, Quadros managed to alienate the Kennedy administration right off the bat. He admired neutralists like Nasser in Egypt and Nehru in India, but he didn't even want to go as far as to be neutral. Brazil would remain pro-West, he said, but the country also wanted to look more to the south to become a leader of the Third World. He certainly did not want to turn resolutely east, but he did want to improve economic relations with the socialist world. For Kennedy, even this much was dangerous. This seemed like an obvious case of do what I say, not what I do. Quadros asked, why should the United States trade with Russia and her satellites, but insist that Brazil trade only with the United States? He announced Brazil would participate in the upcoming Conference of Non-Aligned Countries in Belgrade, the meeting that grew out of Sukarno's 1955 Bandung Conference. He never made it. Just months into his term, Quadros awarded Che Guevara the Cruzeiro do Sul, Brazil's highest award for foreigners. This was pragmatism, not ideology. He hoped Havana could help facilitate trade with socialist countries. Carlos Lacerda, now one of the country's most influential people, began denouncing Quadros everywhere he could. The president abruptly resigned. He expected that the military and widespread popular support would sweep him back into power. They didn't. Brazil sent another representative to the first meeting of the non-aligned movement in Yugoslavia in September. A wildly diverse set of political leaders pledged to pursue peace and development while on a middle course between the poles of Washington and Moscow. But João Jango Goulart, who became president after Quadros resigned, had more pressing problems. Jango and his Brazilian Labor Party were always viewed with deep suspicion by the elite and the military, but he was considered acceptable as the number two man to the union-busting Quadros. Jango as president, however, was seen as well-nigh unthinkable. Lacerda, some outlets in the largely conservative media, and parts of the military hoped to block him from taking power at all. But on September 7, 1961, the grinning 43-year-old, impeccably dressed in a blue suit, arrived to be sworn in as president. From day one, he had almost no political capital. His fatal mistake, considering the posture of the elite, the military, and the United States, was to seek to remedy this by shoring up support among previously neglected sectors of Brazil's population rather than among its political insiders. This had never been done successfully before. Jango backed a set of reforms called the Reformas de Base, which would change Brazilian politics considerably. They would extend voting rights to all Brazilians while unrolling a literacy program around the country. And Goulart backed land reform, despite the fact that he, like much of Brazil's political class, was actually a latifundista, or large landowner, himself. Even he knew this was a gamble. Sustaining this kind of a program meant relying on support from grassroots movements, unions, and the organized left. Goulart also alienated the military high command with reforms that would affect them more directly. He wasn't just proposing to extend the vote to illiterates, he also wanted to allow lower-ranking soldiers to cast ballots. Current law dictated that they could not do so while serving. The idea that he was appealing directly to the lower ranks made the high-ranking officers, who tended to be more conservative than their left-leaning subordinates, very suspicious. If he was ignoring their authority over the lower orders, they could convince themselves perhaps he wanted to overturn their authority entirely. In Brazil, the threat of rebellion from below had terrified elites for 5 centuries, and they always responded successfully with violence. It didn't take Kennedy's White House long to respond either. Django went to visit Washington in early 1962, and it seemed to go okay, though he failed to get any concessions on aid or trade. On July 30th, however, Kennedy had a meeting with Ambassador Gordon, which was recorded. The two men agreed to spend millions on anti-Goulart plans for elections that year and to prepare the ground for a military coup to, as Gordon put it, push him out if it comes to that. Gordon said, "I think one of our important jobs is to strengthen the spine of the military, to make it clear, discreetly, that we are not necessarily hostile to any kind of military action whatsoever if it's clear that the military action is against the left," Kennedy finished. Gordon, "He's giving the damn country to the communists," said Kennedy. "Exactly." After Gordon's July meeting with JFK, CIA money began pouring into Brazil. The agency sent Agent Tim Hogan under deep cover, and he began organizing farmers and labor. Kennedy's administration initiated a counterinsurgency assessment authored by General William H. Draper, Jr., which came to the conclusion that every effort should be made to provide U.S. training for the local army. Years before this, Draper had come to the conclusion that Brazil was the perfect model for the use of the military to fight internal enemies and modernize economies in the Third World. The White House also sent in Vernon Walters, a military attaché with deep ties to Brazil's military, to represent Washington publicly alongside Gordon. It did not matter that Django actually sided with Kennedy when the U.S. detected Soviet missiles in Cuba in 1962. Django publicly backed the blockade of the small island and told Walters in private that he would understand if the North Americans bombed the place. For Washington, he represented the threat of communism in their own hemisphere. Under Kennedy, U.S. activity in Brazil was different from what had been done in Iran and Guatemala in the 1950s. There were no large, noisy interventions with Uncle Sam's hand quite obviously pulling the strings. The U.S. carefully nurtured powerful anti-communist elements and let them know they would have support if they were to act. It was also a major departure from JFK's promises to the Third World and from the original intent behind the Alliance for Progress. That program was now widely seen as an imperfect cover for traditional U.S. policy in the region, not only because Washington continued intervening throughout the region. One of JFK's best biographers put it this way: "How could he square professions of self-determination, a central principle of the alliance, with the reality of secret American interventions in Cuba, Brazil, British Guyana, Peru, Haiti, the Dominican Republic, and every country that seemed vulnerable to left-wing subversion? And that was just the beginning. A June national security directive approved by the president had listed 4 additional Latin American countries sufficiently threatened by communist-inspired insurgency: Ecuador, Colombia, Guatemala, and Venezuela. In Brazil, Goulart's most controversial proposal was land reform, as had been the case in Guatemala under Arbenz. Brazil's landed gentry were horrified by the policy. They withdrew from negotiations and put all their energy into taking down Django instead. Inflation was already out of control, but things got much worse for the economy when all U.S. aid dried up and Brazil's international creditors stopped all further loans, while Washington instead funneled cash to state governors committed to golpe del Estado, or coup, in Brazil. Brazil's Congress caught one U.S.-backed front channeling millions to opposition politicians, and Django shut them down, but that didn't stop the ongoing effective destabilization of his government. With the U.S. now effectively leading an international capital strike, Django struggled to finance basic state functions. He certainly had no help from the men in Moscow. After the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Soviets did not want to cause any trouble in Washington's backyard. Then, Carlos Lacerda, the man who had played a role in the end of both the Vargas and Quadros presidencies, acted again. In October 1963, he gave an interview to Julian Hart, the Brazil correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, and therefore my own predecessor, in which he accused Django of plotting a coup himself, calling him a golpista, Portuguese for putschist, and asked Washington to intervene. Washington officials knew, as did everyone else, that if Django was going down, it would be the military that would depose him. Just as in Indonesia, the armed forces in Brazil were the country's most reliably anti-communist force, but their allegiance to this ideology went far deeper than was the case in Indonesia. It was even deeper than the Cold War. In some ways, the Americans could not hope for a better ally, and this perfect anti-communist partnership grew out of a powerful legend going back to 1935, when a younger President Vargas had used a sputtering left-wing revolt to crack down on communists and build a dictatorship. The Legend of the Ententona. The Brazilian Communist Party was founded in 1922 largely by immigrants and former anarchists. When they immediately joined Lenin's recently established Communist International, Moscow had little idea what to do with them. The Comintern classified Brazil as a large semi-colonial country in the same category as China and put it on the back burner. At the time, the directive the Brazilians got from the Soviets was to form a united front with the national bourgeoisie against imperialism without communist leadership, in the same way that Mao was ordered to work with Chiang Kai-shek with very mixed results. Brazil's Communist Party was mostly committed to that line, but it also operated in a country where military plotting was routine for every political tendency. Getúlio Vargas first took power in a military coup in 1930, and after he began taking cues from the fascist movements in Italy and Spain, a man named Luis Carlos Prestes, a charismatic communist lieutenant who had once attempted a failed left populist revolt, founded the Aliança Nacional Libertadora, ANL. The ANL was opposed to fascism and integralismo, which in Brazil was a rapidly anti-communist kind of Catholic local variant of fascism. The Aliança included many moderate supporters of Vargas who wanted to pull him back from the right and also gained the backing of the Communist Party itself. Moscow did not set up the ANL, nor did it order the National Liberation Alliance to act. Indeed, the Soviets were worried the Brazilians were being reckless and adventurous. However, when communist leaders in Moscow realized that Prestes might launch another rebellion, they didn't want to be left out. They sent a small advisory staff, including a German explosives specialist and Victor Allen Baron, a U.S. citizen and communications expert who was tasked with communicating with communist leadership back in Russia. Most of the civilians in the Communist Party and the ANL didn't know any preparations were underway for a rebellion, and it started on accident up in Natal in poor northeastern Brazil after soldiers there became enraged by the dismissal of some colleagues. The Communist Party there asked the soldiers to wait, but to no avail. The rebellion exploded, and rebels actually took control of the city for a time, commandeering cars and robbing the banks. When the uprising reached Recife, also in the northeast, the government's response was a slaughter, as the military put down the uprising and executed the leftist rebels. It was a brutal, tremendous repression. They killed left and right, crooked and straight. The life of a communist wasn't worth 10 bits of raw honey, said Lieutenant Lamartine Coutinho, using an old Portuguese expression we might translate as, wasn't worth shit. Then the final act came on a small beach just around the bend from Copacabana in Rio de Janeiro. The attack began in the wee hours of the morning on November 27, 1935. Military troops launched a grenade toward the barracks, which blew up in front of a pillar. Then they opened fire. It was an ugly, horrible battle, said one of the soldiers under attack that morning. Shots all over the place. But in the end, only two soldiers died in combat. The ANL had recklessly wasted human lives, probably dozens across the country, and only succeeded in handing themselves over to the government to be used as they pleased. As it happened, the story of a failed communist coup played right into the hands of the elites that were pushing for a rightward shift at the time. The powerful newspaper O Globo had already published an entirely false report, signed in June by owner Roberto Marinho, that communists had received orders to take over the country by shooting all non-communist officials, preferably at the doors of their homes or even after invading their domiciles. The Vargas government used the real event, from then on somewhat incorrectly referred to as Intentona Comunista, or Communist Uprising, to crack down on the left and his critics in general, and then as an excuse to consolidate dictatorial powers. Vargas declared a state of emergency, created the Committee for the Repression of Communism, suspended individual liberties, and began to round up the country's leftists. Many of the Intentona's leaders were executed, though the popular Prestes remained in jail. Authorities banned left-wing books. The tale of violent communist subversion served the needs of the right-wing elements in the military and government so effectively that they created another one. In 1937, a general found a document outlining the Plano Cohen, a Jewish communist plot, capitalizing on anti-Semitism on the fascist right, that included directives to invade the houses of wealthy Brazilians and rape them. Vargas used this entirely fabricated plan to authorize a new military coup, promulgate a new constitution, and take control of a full-fledged dictatorship. The 1935 Intentona served as a foundational legend for the armed forces and for the increasingly virulent anti-communist movement that overtook the military and society in general. Every year, on November 27th, the military gathered in front of a memorial structure on Praia Vermelha, or Red Beach, to commemorate the defense against the communist rebellion, and a powerful myth took shape. The military came to tell the story that November 1935 was not a conventional attack on military barracks. The tale became that communists snuck into the chambers of officers and stabbed them to death while they slept. This parable of unique communist evil was disproved many decades later by careful historical investigation. As historian Rodrigo Pato Samata affirms, citing autopsy reports, no one died from a stab wound that morning. After all, it would be curious to imagine professionals from the Brazilian armed forces, no matter what their political convictions, carrying out a military uprising using daggers. Communists with knives drawn, ready to stab you in your sleep, became a common trope in Brazil's voluminous anti-communist material over the next few decades. In the press, you could also find illustrations indicating that communists were insects that could only be exterminated with liberty, the family, and morality. Communism was called a plague, a virus, or cancer, terms that were also hurled at communists at the time in nearby Argentina. More often than not, communism was associated with pure evil or witchcraft, drawn with the use of demons or satanic beasts such as dragons, snakes, and goats. There was often the implication or outright depiction of sexual perversion and deviancy. Launching false accusations of communism could also be profitable. Police, soldiers, and low-level politicians would find evidence that a certain citizen was communist, earning more resources for their departments, or very often, generating direct bribes. The fascist political party Ação Integralista Brasileira, AIB, reportedly used classic extortion tactics on small businesses, but with an anti-communist twist. In the dark of night, party members would cover the walls of shops and homes with seemingly communist graffiti. Then they'd show up a few days later, asking the owners to make donations to the AIB to prove to the concerned citizens in the neighborhood that they weren't actually communists. In the 1950s and early 1960s, Brazil's military deepened its ties with Washington. The U.S. maintained its largest service missions in Brazil, and Brazilian officers received extra appointments to train at Fort Leavenworth's command school alongside all those soldiers from Indonesia. For Brazil's many right-wing elements, especially in the military, Jango's entire presidency was a mistake. But in 1961, Jango made a blunder that upset the military further. The announcement that Brazil would reopen relations with the Soviet Union came just days before the annual commemoration of the Intentona and was seen as a provocation. Not long after, one of the country's armed far-right groups, Movimento Anticomunista, MAC, covered Rio de Janeiro in graffiti, with slogans like "Death to the traitors," "Let us shoot fellow Brazilians," "Moscow's secular forces," and "War to the death for the PCB," the country's still illegal communist party. It is widely believed the MAC received funding from the CIA and carried out several bombings, as well as shooting up the National Student Union. Another anti-communist group, the Society for the Defense of Tradition, Family, and Property, TFP, founded in 1960 in Sao Paulo, sought to counter the decadent threat of international communism by forcing its youth brigades to cut their hair short, wear modest clothing, refrain from watching TV, and learn to fight karate. TFP was international in its vision and soon established chapters across Latin America, in South Africa, and in the United States. As for the actual Brazilian Communist Party, it split in 1962. Under the leadership of Luiz Carlos Prestes, still influential decades later, the PCB had gone along with Khrushchev's decision to move away from Stalinism and remained committed to working peacefully within the boundaries of Brazilian democracy. A splinter group, more inspired by Mao and convinced of the need for outright revolution, rejected this revisionism and formed the almost identically named Partido Comunista do Brasil, PCdoB. Under Jango's government, the PCB was actually much more moderate than other actors on the left at the time, since they didn't even support updating the constitution. All this anti-communist fire and brimstone was directed at opposing a president who was, at most, a liberal reformist. But Jango looked very likely to win re-election in 1965. If he had eventually succeeded in enabling more people to vote, the country would have changed in very noticeable ways for the elites, and these changes were supported by the country's small number of communists who really did exist. If you were opposed to anything that communists approved of and terrified of the consequences that social reform would have had in a country like Brazil, you could find many reasons to oppose Jango. If you accepted all the tenets of fanatical anti-communism, as J. Edgar Hoover laid them out back in the 1940s, and the Brazilian elite and U.S. government did, their opposition made sense. The association between Jango and clandestine communism did not just lurk on the dark, right-wing fringes of Brazilian society. A January 1964 cartoon in O Globo, the newspaper published by what is still Brazil's most important media group, ran with the headline, "The Literacy Campaign," referring to Jango's plan to teach more people to learn to read and write. On the right sat a dirty man in ragged clothes, his face the picture of ignorance. On the left, his teacher, pointing at him and cackling. Behind the instructor, protruding from his suit, is a long devil's tail with a hammer and sickle stamped on its pointy tip. Three down. In the fall of 1963, President John F. Kennedy ordered his ambassador in South Vietnam to facilitate the removal of President Diem. As an ally, Diem was now causing Washington more trouble than he was worth. The CIA passed the word along to a local general, and on November 1, 1963, Diem was kidnapped along with his brother, and they were both shot and stabbed in the back of an armored personnel carrier. Kennedy hadn't actually wanted Diem killed, but he knew that he was responsible for his death, and the assassination shook and badly depressed the young president. A few weeks later, Kennedy himself was murdered while driving through Dallas. The men closest to him, knowing they had been actively trying to get rid of Castro and were using methods that were far from innocent all over the world, scrambled to guess who had done it. Bobby Kennedy himself suspected the killing might have been the work of the CIA, the mob, or Castro, all of which would have meant he himself was partly responsible. Vice President Lyndon Johnson's first suspicion was that it was retaliation for Diem's murder. Johnson did not even know the administration had been trying to kill Castro, and as he took over the presidency, he struggled to wrap his mind around the network of covert operations he would inherit. Lyndon Baines Johnson was a hardworking, all-American Christian from Texas. LBJ was liberal, probably more so than Kennedy, and regarded as the master of the Senate, where he had served as its incredibly powerful leader for 6 years. But when it came to foreign policy, he was less experienced. He had none of Kennedy's appreciation for the historical battles between imperialism and national revolution in the Third World. According to biographer Doris Kearns Goodwin, who knew him well, Johnson held an all-too-common American belief that the rest of the world was basically just like the USA, but a bit behind. He held a belief in the universal applicability of American values, the existence of a global consensus, she wrote. But LBJ didn't have the confidence in his own mastery of foreign policy to challenge the men left behind by Kennedy, so he often neglected foreign affairs, deferring to the wisdom of these advisors. In Brazil, covert operations were well underway. CIA agent Tim Hogan and military attaché Vernon Walters were already in the country and active. They were using both the military and economy against the president. The screws were tightening around Jango. The influential daily Jornal do Brasil published an editorial, Basta, which would serve as the rallying cry for the country's golpistas. Before we arrive at revolution, we say enough. We say that as long as there are organized, cohesive, and disciplined Brazilian armed forces, enough. The time has come. We register the death of the false politics of class reconciliation carried out by the president's witchcraft and spells. National patience has its limits. In late November, just days after Kennedy was killed, Django attended the country's annual celebration of the defeat of that fabled Intentona Comunista on the Red Beach in Rio de Janeiro. His presence only served to annoy many of the country's most committed conservatives, who went as far as to boycott the ceremony and organize other anti-communist events nearby. At that commemoration, on November 27, 1963, Army General Jair Dantas Ribeiro gave a terse, ominous speech. In the quiet of the night, driven by principles never understood, extremist groups took off on an inglorious endeavor, he began. Without flag and without cause, without ideals and without a destination, the action of these adventurers found no echo in the heart of the nation, whose Christian structure is entirely immune to hate and extremism. Speaking with Django in the audience, he continued, "Those hateful terrorists of 1935, raising the communist shield that means only ruin and rancor, propagating humanitarian popular sentiments that in reality served only to hide subaltern proposals and thirst for power, murdering treacherously in the shadow of night, our armed brothers, wrote a black page in the history of Brazil. We should not, however, suppress this story. That attempt remains an example for these pests who want to install an anti-democratic regime. For now and forever, the example of the army and its vigilance will remain and serve as a warning." For Ribeiro, the pests were communists, and military officers were already formulating their own theories as to Django's intentions. Many were now convinced that in addition to giving low-level soldiers the vote, he would appeal directly to them, subverting the authority of the superior officers. Brazil's right-wing forces began to spread the idea that it was actually Django who planned his own left-wing coup. They charged that to get his reforms implemented, he would shut down the government, abolish Congress, or declare a new constitution. The country's major newspapers helped to disseminate this story. If this was true, the thinking went, a coup that removed him from power would actually save democracy. U.S. Ambassador Lincoln Gordon shared this view, and since Django was a weak president, Gordon speculated, he might be supplanted by even more radical, maybe communist, forces later if he wasn't stopped now. Behind the scenes, the Americans were coordinating with the military. In March, Gordon sent a cable back to Washington. He wrote, "My considered conclusion is that Goulart is now definitely engaged on campaign to seize dictatorial power, accepting the active collaboration of the Brazilian Communist Party and of other radical left revolutionaries to this end. If he were to succeed, it is more than likely that Brazil would come under full communist control." The Americans had their eyes on a specific Brazilian replacement. Gordon continued, "The most significant development is the crystallizing of a military resistance group under the leadership of General Humberto Castelo, sic, Branco, Army Chief of Staff. Castelo Branco is a highly competent, discreet, honest, and deeply respected officer. Castelo Branco's preference would be to act only in case of obvious unconstitutional provocation, e.g. a Goulartist move to close Congress or to intervene in one of the opposition states, Guanabara or Sao Paulo being the most likely ones. He recognizes, however, as do I, that Goulart may avoid such obvious provocation while continuing to move toward an irreversible fait accompli by means of manipulated strikes, financial undermining of the states, and an executive plebiscite, including voting by illiterates." Earlier in his life, Castelo Branco had trained at Fort Leavenworth in Kansas. There, he had met Vernon Walters, the military attaché Kennedy sent to Brazil. After they studied together in Kansas, Castelo Branco and Walters were roommates, living together in a small hotel in Italy. Given the circumstances that led to his inauguration, Django had almost no support in Congress and had few allies in Brazil's media, much of which was owned by a few powerful landowning families. In order to demonstrate public support for his reforms, he organized a series of street rallies. On March 13, 1964, Django gathered with other left-leaning leaders to speak to nearly 200,000 people in front of Central do Brasil, the iconic train station in downtown Rio. A tense Django took the stage, called again for land reform, and attacked right-wing false Democrats for being anti-people, anti-union, and anti-reform. He said, "Meeting with the people on the streets is not a threat to democracy. A threat to democracy is when you pounce on the people, exploiting their Christian beliefs, and the mystifications of an anti-communist industry. They are a threat to democracy." Cameras caught some attendees carrying signs with slogans like "Down with the Latifundistas," a photo of Fidel, and "Legalize the Communist Party," more fuel for the right-wing conspiracists. The conservatives responded with their own rally. On March 19th, just a few miles from the Tan family's new home in Sao Paulo, the Marcha da Familia com Deus pela Liberdade, or March of the Family with God and for Liberty, brought almost 500,000 people to the streets. Most of them were from well-off conservative families, though some forced their maids to come, and the presence of respectable women and children emboldened the scheming military officers. Ngoc Tan and her family, living just miles away, were wary of these kinds of things and stayed away. The U.S. government did not. It supplied material and moral support to the march, which was already well-grounded in homegrown Brazilian elite attitudes. Django's final and fatal error, as far as the military was concerned, came just after that. A group of 2,000 Marines in Rio, supporters of the Reformas da Base, staged a little rebellion against their superiors, demanding better working conditions and a relaxation of their disciplinary code. The rebels showed the pro-mutiny, anti-imperial Soviet classic film The Battleship Potemkin, which did little to calm nerves back at military high command. Django's initial response, neither to support the uprising nor back an immediate crackdown, served as ultimate proof to the military that the president would support an uprising of low-level soldiers and subvert the military hierarchy. To make matters worse, he gave a talk to military police at the Brazil Automobile Club the next day. He didn't say anything radical, but by then it was considered a direct affront that he would even speak directly to sergeants and low-level officials. The coup against Django began on March 31, 1964, and many of the plotters were motivated by the belief that communists had built some kind of revolutionary plan around Goulart. This was entirely false, but it was also entirely consistent with the fanatical anti-communism of the time, all the way back to the McCarthy hearings and the mythology surrounding the Intentona. Wherever there were communists, no matter how limited in number, and no matter what their stated declarations, they must have a secret, nefarious plot. Within the mythology of Brazil's own anti-communism, this likely meant the communists had something deeply perverse planned. Many in the elite believed that communists practiced violence that they carried out with satanic pleasure, that it was their deep desire to murder the faithful en masse and deliver them to red hell. Although the military high command and Washington had been plotting a coup for weeks, it started prematurely. A single outraged general, Olimpio Morao Filho, the same man who had created the fake Jewish communist conspiracy known as the Cohen Plan back in 1937, led a march of poorly equipped soldiers on Rio, where Django was in residence. Goulart flew to Brasilia, but when it became clear to him that the military high command was dead set on removing him, he fled to Uruguay. Tanks rolled up and parked outside Congress. Invoking an institutional act with no legal basis, the military junta declared that the left-wing members of the Congreso Nacional had lost all their legal rights. As the coup began, the U.S. State Department began an operation it dubbed Brother Sam and made tankers, ammunition, and aircraft carriers available to the conspirators. None of these were needed. The Brazilian Congress declared the presidency vacant in clear violation of the Constitution. Then, after that first institutional act removed about 40 of their left-wing colleagues from office, 361 of Brazil's remaining lawmakers voted to install General Castelo Branco as president. Almost all of Brazil's media supported the coup. U.S. assistance began to pour back in. With Django gone, the military delivered a very different kind of speech at the 1964 memorial of the 1935 Intentona. General Perry Constant Bevilacqua declared, "The fatherland is here. There it is in this beautiful flag. As we contemplate it, we feel your presence, you heroes of November 1935. Ambassador Lincoln Gordon called the 1964 coup the single most decisive victory for freedom in the mid-20th century. As Brazilian historian Marco Napolitano puts it, Just as in a Hollywood film, there was a happy ending, for the plotters, that is. The communist bad guys and their sympathizers were deposed, the good guys were in power, and best of all, this was achieved without the United States needing to appear as a visible agent of the conspiracy. This was huge and novel. In Iran, 1953, and Guatemala, 1954, Indonesia, 1958, and Cuba, 1961, anyone who was paying attention knew that Washington had been behind the regime change operations. These very obvious signs of U.S. intervention had not only tainted Washington's image worldwide, they had undermined the efficacy of the states they installed when they were victorious. Guatemala's government fell apart quickly after the CIA-backed coup, as did the Shah's government in Iran, eventually. This achievement in Brazil in 1964 was not only possible because of the new tactics JFK put in place to build alliances with the military. The United States also got lucky. And importantly, Brazil had its own very deep anti-communist tradition built on 5 centuries of fear of the black, the poor, and the violent and marginalized, and with its own incredibly effective myths and annual rituals. Despite his support among the population, the legally elected Jango did not mount a counteroffensive. He likely believed that this, like other coups in Brazilian history, would be a minor reset to the system, and that he would be able to regroup and run in the next election. He was wrong. Brazil would not hold another democratic election for 25 years. Washington's commitment to military-led modernization remained strong during the Johnson administration, and Brazil was now one of the most important U.S. allies in the Cold War. Indeed, Latin America's largest country would soon play a crucial role in flipping other countries into the Western camp.